Do you freeze up when someone says they want to really know you? Does your spouse tell you she feels lonely? We're going to talk about intimacy in this episode of Recovery Support with Kevin Bergen. This is Recovery Support, and I'm Kevin Bergen, licensed psychotherapist. This show is to support those in recovery from sexually compulsive behavior and to offer that support with education, inspiration, and motivation. So much of my work with sex addiction is wrapped around the core problem of sexaholism. No, it's not a sex problem. It's an intimacy problem. Specifically, men seem to have trouble conceptualizing what intimacy even is, let alone engaging in it. Today's reading will be from When Men Think Private Thoughts by Gordon MacDonald. His subtitle is Exploring the Issues That Captivate the Minds of Men. Now, I found this book to be thoughtful, informative, entertaining, and very helpful. I'm going to share most of Mr. MacDonald's chapter called The Mysteries of Intimacy. An understanding of intimacy is crucial to the recovery of any sex addict. I'll begin now on page 16 of When Men Think Private Thoughts by Gordon MacDonald. In the files of a man's private thoughts, few topics take up more room than ones that build off a cluster of questions something like these. Who do I really know? How well do I know them? Who knows the real me? And now that I think about it, what is there about me that's worth knowing? And if anyone took the time to know me, I mean really, really know me, what's to say the person would want me as a friend, as a husband, or as a father? These are merely sample questions. There's scores of others behind them. They're jagged, inconsistent. But they speak to a confusion that often whirls in the private thoughts. Why do I struggle to connect naturally with other people? There are some mysteries here, and the greatest mystery is what intimacy really means. An ex-Marine looks back to another time in life. Quote, I never thought I'd say this, but some of the best days of my life were in the Marines when we were in Nam. I ran with a bunch of guys who went through hell together. We saw men die, get shot to pieces, go crazy. And in the midst of it all, we got closer as friends than I ever believed possible. There was nothing we couldn't say to each other, nothing we couldn't do for one another. You've heard about the guy who throws himself on a grenade to save a friend's life? Any of us would have done that. We talked about everything. We laughed. We cried. We hated. We dreamed. We screamed. Even had some fistfights. Everything together. But one thing we knew more than almost anything else. We loved each other in a way that I have never experienced since. I don't think I'll ever have friends like that again. I miss that kind of closeness. The guys I know at church, at work, there's nothing like that with them. Even my wife will never know me like those guys did. Unquote. The man describes a version, a powerful version, of intimacy. What happens when men begin to connect beneath the surface of events and circumstances, somewhere near the level of the soul? Men and women can work together, engage in sexual relationships together, and share strong moments of emotional intensity together, but they may not necessarily ever know each other in this way. We were built for intimacy, this linkage of souls, but most of us men rarely experience it. And its scarcity breeds loneliness. I don't really know anyone. And it fuels remoteness. No one really knows me. A man feels this loneliness when he analyzes the conversations that mark his day. Why, he wonders, is it a no-brainer to discuss ball scores, investments, bad general managers, and how the other political party is ruining the country? In contrast, why is it a struggle to explore matters of the soul with others? Where I'm at, or not at, with God? Why I admire you? what I wish I could change about my life, how sad or fearful I feel, and why I feel so ashamed. Why, the wondering continues, do I have the impulse to cover up my weaknesses when I would really like to talk about them with a mind toward improving upon them? Why do I feel strange in moments when something like tenderness is called for? Is there a reason I feel as if I fall so short of whatever it is that would satisfy my wife's desire for understanding? Now, this is Kevin Bergen talking again. I'm going to summarize an idea that Gordon MacDonald gives here in the next couple pages. He talks about the release of the book, The Bridges of Madison County, in the early 90s. He talks about having breakfast with a friend of his who encouraged him to read the book. And when Gordon asked why, he told him that his wife had read it and she forced it on him to read. She wanted him to read it. And what they discovered, that there was a lot of women who were asking their husbands to read this. What were they looking for? Why were they trying to get their husbands to understand what was going on in this book? He bought the book, and after a chapter or two, he saw what he thought everybody was talking about, at least the women. It was about women who seemed to have everything, everything but an enduring, satisfying human intimacy. The story in the book, The Bridges of Madison County, is about a Midwestern woman who lives with her husband. He owns a ranch, and they have two children. At first glance, everything looks perfect between all of them. He's a hardworking, admirable husband, father, everything else. And he ends up taking the kids to a state fair, and the wife is going to be left alone for a week. While they're gone, there's a photographer that wanders by. Robert Kincaid is his name. He's in the area, and he's there to photograph the covered bridges of Iowa's Madison County. He gets lost. He stops and asks for directions at this house where this wife, this mom, is home alone for a week. Well, you can only imagine. Things happen between the two of them. There's some kind of a connection. There's a romance. They have a little affair. And toward the end of the book, he asks her to go away with him, to have this kind of wandering life of freedom. And she really has to make a choice. The question is, why did she have to think about that choice? She had got some kind of connection with this photographer guy that came up. Little words that were said, little physical things that were done, there was a connection. Somehow, he seemed to speak to her heart. She spoke to his. It addressed that loneliness that she had been feeling in her marriage. So I'm going to pick up again here in When Men Think Private Thoughts, at the bottom of page 20. If there's a word to describe the something missing, it's intimacy. Use words like connection, communication, bonding, caring, and closeness. You hover all about the meaning of the word. If food and water are essential to physical life, intimacy is essential to spiritual life. The word covers the exchanges of positive spiritual energy that occur between one person and another. All of his life, a man in his deepest parts wishes to give love and receive it. That he might express himself otherwise is a betrayal of his real self, a betrayal that happens near the surface of himself in the world of the rational, where winning, achieving, accumulating, and overpowering become momentarily important. But descend through the trapdoor of all this sound and fury, and you'll find in the deepest parts a desperate desire to be, as the Bible puts it, one flesh with other human beings. Whether we use the word intimacy or the biblical term one flesh, the meaning is pretty much the same. Do not reduce the word to mere sexual intimations, or you'll miss a large part of this implication. The woman on the Iowa farm was not seeking sexual intimacy when she met the photographer. She was apparently quite happy with life as she knew it. Happy, that is, until Kincaid came and represented new levels of possibility that she had either never known or had chosen to ignore. Her husband, the faithful farmer, knew how to provide for her, protect her, and maintain all the routines of life on her behalf. But he didn't know how to know her. And he didn't know how to make himself known. More than anything else, The Bridges of Madison County is a book about intimacy, becoming one flesh. It features a man who, according to the author's definition of intimacy, knew how to do that, and another who did not. The message is a simple one. As a rule, men struggle to connect. Most of them in our modern world don't connect very well. Connecting, a substitute word for intimacy, describes the ability human beings are said to have that, I'll use an old computer term here, enables hearts to handshake. Why do men struggle so much in this area? Why do a significant percentage of the female population find such disappointment in the shallowness of connection that they ultimately feel with their husbands? Why do most children feel a lifelong distance from their fathers? And why do men confess that making and sustaining friendships is among the most difficult challenges of their lives? Samuel Osherson writes well on this issue in his book Wrestling with Love, and employs an interesting term, attachment battles. Quote, an attachment battle is an inner conflict between our need to connect and our reluctance to connect. It occurs often unseen and unnoticed in relationships with women, children, parents, colleagues, and other men. I believe this is one of the most important issues facing men today. Often we fight with those we love or become sullenly detached or abusive because we are unable to deal with the ambivalent yearnings that love creates for us as men. Unquote. For those of us who turn to the Hebrew Christian scriptures as the starting point for our view of reality, intimacy is best understood in its most positive form in the earliest pages of the Bible. The biblical writer describes the first man and woman in terms like these. The two are naked and feel no shame. We often use the word naked to refer to the unclothed human body. My bet is that the biblical writer uses it in a much larger sense. Here, nakedness has to do not only with an unclothed body, but also with an unclothed soul. If the soul is understood to be the deepest depths of the human being, then nakedness suggests two people who are totally open to each other, no secrets. There's reasons for such a relational status. First, all energies of each person are thoroughly attuned to engaging the other for the highest and best purposes. There's a common sense of mission in life, to honor and obey the Creator who has challenged them to manage creation. Second, there seems to have been an appreciation of each other's beauty. Adam sings the first known love song as he gazes upon Eve. In Genesis chapter 2, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. One picks up a sense of unvarnished delight in the prospect of being together. This is in contrast to the loneliness felt before Eve entered Adam's life. Third, there's an absence of any shame or guilt. Neither has offended the other, nor have they offended God, so embarrassment, humiliation, and fear of being found out don't exist in this relationship. Each can present his or her soul to the other without fear that something is amiss. Interrupting this narrative, the writer of the story looks to his own time and explains why men and women seek each other out. Quote from Genesis 2, therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Implied in this sentence are these things. A man has experienced intimacy of a kind with his father and mother. Now he seeks a different intimacy with his wife. He is also, by implication, to find other kinds of intimacies with friends and later his children. I believe that this magnificent biblical story is among the most important stories of a man's life. For it's our beginning point. It explains what we were made to be and to experience. It explains why there is a longing, a deep sense of loss in the soul of every man. It suggests how we were wired by the Creator and points the way to why we feel bad when this spiritual circuitry does not work. But something went terribly wrong in this story. In the long view of things, it went wrong when our ancestors, the first generation of men and women, made choices that severely restricted their ability to be intimate with each other. They found themselves hiding from God, ashamed of themselves, accusing and blaming each other, and running from self-exposure. They were trapped in a strange ambivalence. They had a desire to know each other intimately, but it was blocked by an even greater need to hide from each other. Even though this instinct to experience intimacy, connection at the soul level, has been terribly wounded, we nevertheless feel the loss when we can't experience it. All our lives, we pursue differing versions of intimacy. We experience our first sense of intimacy with our mothers, and then, we hope, with our fathers. If we fail in these first two pursuits, we're likely to live with the loss for the remainder of our lives. Soon, there are those first intimacies with boyhood friends. We build forts together, start clubs, fool with secret passwords and codes and signals. We play on teams, explore the topic of sex, as much through humor as anything. We complain about our parents and fortify each other in our first attempts to figure out the world of girls. Some of us develop remarkably intense friendships with friends that will last a lifetime. Then the time arrives for us to understand intimacy in a third category. We experiment with the meaning of connection with a woman. Can she be trusted? Will she find value in me? What do I have to offer? In each of these phases, from parents to friends to women, there are all sorts of ways in which our experience can be inhibited. We are most prone to engage in intimacy in places we think to be safe. Safe in the arms of a mother? Safe in the presence of a father? Safe with friends with whom we've built up trust? In such safe environments, we experiment with opening up our deeper selves and in exploring the hidden parts of others. But if ever the trust is betrayed, we may spend a lifetime in the belief that no place is safe and that no person can be trusted. Therefore, little or no intimacy. Some examples may clarify this point. The ability to engage at intimate levels is affected when, in moments of high trust, we are humiliated or betrayed. In a discussion circle, a man tells us his story, quote, "When I was about 5 or 6, I told my mother one evening about a girl who lived near us and who was in my first grade class at school. I thought I loved her, I said. Someday I would marry her, I predicted, and we would live down the street not far away so that I could come home and have dinner every evening. Kinda dumb, huh? But that's not the end of the story. An evening or two later, my mother entertained a group of women in our home. I was in bed trying to go to sleep when I began to hear peals of laughter from downstairs. Wondering what it was all about, I tiptoed to the top of the stairs and began to listen. They were talking about their children, exchanging stories about crazy things kids do and say. Suddenly, I heard my mother begin to tell the women what I'd confided to her a few days before. And what made it worse for me was the realization that the mother of the girl I'd talked about was there in the group. I can't describe what it did to me to hear my mother telling my secret to those women, especially to that other mother. And the feeling was compounded when my mother made a joke of it and everyone joined in even greater laughter. It was as if I'd been stripped of everything, and I remember thinking that night, I'll never tell my mother a secret ever again. And I wonder if that was the night I decided I'd never tell any woman my secrets. For the only thing worse than my mother's voice was the pain of that laughter. I feel a coldness in myself whenever I hear women laugh at a table in a restaurant or in a corner at a cocktail party. I have this irrational feeling that they're cackling about something some man said or did. Unquote. Intimacy is affected when we're brainwashed into believing that we must go it alone and trust no one. A group of men are telling father stories. One of them recounts the following. My dad was from the old country. He was tough and he worked harder than anyone I've ever seen. He ran a one-man coal business, and when I was old enough, he had me down at the coal yard running errands, cleaning things, and finally, even beginning to deal with the customers. I bet I heard my father say the same thing in the same way 10,000 times. You can't depend on anybody in this world. If you want something done, you do it yourself. Never get in a spot where you need anybody. And if I felt sick or tired, he'd say, don't bleed on me. No one's interested in how you feel. Stand on your own 2 feet. Gut it through. You hear that sort of thing enough times, and you begin to believe it. And that's the way I've learned to live life. I don't depend on nobody, and don't bleed on nobody. Not my wife, not my kids, and I work too hard to have close friends. So I guess I've become what my father said I should. The ability to be an intimate person can be affected when nothing in our present experience matches the past. A former athlete says, I was an interior lineman starting freshman, and I played every game for 4 years without a serious injury. There were 3 other guys on the line that played with me almost the entire time. I can't tell you how much we loved each other. We won. We lost. We helped each other through injuries, through good and bad romances, through studies. There wasn't anything we didn't do together. I could cry with those guys. I could sit up all night and drink with them. There wasn't anything we couldn't say to each other. I mean, there were some times when we got good and mad at one another. I guess that says it all. And now I'm 38. I'm still grieving. When football was over and we said goodbye, it was like a death. Intimacy is affected when someone we love turns against us. We've come to a point where nakedness feels good and things held down in the heart are beginning to reach the surface where they can be appreciated and processed. And then, as one man said, we'd been going together since high school. And after 2 years of college, we decided that we couldn't wait any longer, so we got married. It was a tough time. She had to quit school and work so that I could finish, but I did finish. Even did some graduate work. I thought we were really on our way, and I really loved her. We didn't have a lot of money, so we had to do a lot of cheap things like camping and hiking. Then the roof fell in. One day she told me that there was someone else. She'd been fooling around for almost a year, and I'd never picked up a hint of it. How's that for being sensitive? So she left, and she's living with him. Now I think about all the times we were together, the things I felt free to tell her, and I thought all the time that we were getting closer, but she was moving away. I think the thing that has really gotten to me is the feeling that I'll never be able to trust anyone again. You talk about opening your soul. Look where it got me. When men open the files of their private thoughts and ponder the issue of intimacy, these kinds of stories may bubble to the surface. You can easily detect the hurt and disillusionment, and you're not surprised if one of the storytellers admits that he's had a difficult time trusting ever since. Many of us have stories that are 30 or 40 years old, but the feeling of betrayal has lasted with an unexplained freshness. How we deal with these stories and how we decide to seek healing of wounds that have caused us to build walls around ourselves may be among the most important decisions we ever make. That ends our reading today from Chapter 2 of Gordon MacDonald's book, When Men Think Private Thoughts. I'd like you to reflect on some of these ideas about intimacy. Did you hear yourself in this reading today? Do you struggle with intimacy, even understanding what it is or how to get it? I'll continue next week in the podcast reading some more as it turns to sexual intimacy and how that affects those who are struggling with sex addiction. Thank you for being with me today. I'm thinking of changing the frequency that the Recovery Support Podcast is released to once or maybe twice a month. You may notice I've already slackened the weekly schedule. What do you think? I need to know if this affects you in any way. I've had very little feedback about whether the podcast makes any impact for you, and that's why I'm considering the reduced release schedule. My aim in producing the show is to provide a helpful pick-me-up for those in recovery by maybe providing some readings and reminders in a format not otherwise available. If you still want weekly episodes, I need to know. You can email me and let me know at kbrecoverysupport@gmail.com. This Recovery Support Podcast doesn't promote any program or fellowship and only informs about resources that I have found helpful to my clients. You can refer to the show notes at recoverysupport.podbean.com. Have a terrific week and have a sober day.